Good morning, everybody. I just want to say, I just felt during our worship time this morning, we sang some great words. We declared our hearts in those words, I hope. But my feeling is, if we want God to take us at our word, then we have to allow him to break us out of patterns that we can get into. I don't know what else to say about that, but that's just what I just came to be so strongly this morning, that if we really want to be abandoned to God's praise, then he may want to do something in and through us and in our midst that we don't expect. I think that it's good for us at least to be open to the possibility of that. I think we don't have to worry about that, we don't have to plan for it, but we do have to allow the Spirit to take hold of what we do. Our offering of praise and worship in whichever form it may be, and be prepared to just allow God to surprise us in what it is that he wants to do in our midst, both on a Sunday morning and throughout the week, of course. Now, don't feel that's entirely not unrelevant, is that a word, to what I want to say this morning, because as I was preparing this, I just felt the Spirit of God moving through in exactly the same way that we've just been singing. Now, if you don't feel the Spirit of God moving through and you're preparing a sermon, you're probably in trouble. I just had a sense. So I pray, and my prayer this morning is that our service isn't split up into sections. It's one continuous whole, and the Spirit of God moves through the whole, and he wants to take that procession and to make it into something more than the sum of its parts. Does that make sense? Luke 23. I just wanted to make sure to tell you that I wasn't asleep in last week's sermon, and that yes, there is an overlap between the two readings, okay? But that's for good reason. It's not because I forgot what Darren said last week. And I just want to point out that although the reading, the phrase that Jesus used, that we spoke on last week, Father forgive them for they do not know what they're doing, they know not what they do, is in this passage, it's not that one that we're concentrating on this morning. It's the second thing that he says right at the end of the reading, where he speaks to the criminal on the cross and he says, truly I tell you today, you will be with me in paradise. That's where I'm heading to. But as I prepared this, we're right in the middle of the crucifixion. And I realised that I didn't want to just talk about and focus particularly, to start with at least, on that second criminal. It's not just about how a demonstration, but it is a very powerful demonstration, isn't it, about how we can come to faith in Jesus at any time. We might have faith for 50 years, or we may have faith for 50 minutes, and yet Jesus still accepts us. It's about that for sure. But I realized as I reflected and prayed and just read through this passage that in order to do justice to this, and in fact I realized in order to do justice to the whole of this sermon series, these seven words from the cross, we mustn't just look at them as sort of random things that Jesus sort of fired out in response to circumstances. But as we look at these passages, we need to go on a journey towards and into the humiliation of the cross. And it's one of the reasons why I'm not starting with some story or attempt of a joke or anything, because I just got grabbed by this, and I just felt we need to take this journey this morning, and we'll continue, I guess, to take this journey over the next weeks as we look at these various aspects. The journey of the humiliation of the cross. Here is the Son of God. Here, as we sing sometimes, the hands that flung stars into space, to cruel nails surrendered. And it's, theologians will call it the humiliation of the cross, but nevertheless, and they mean different things by that, but it still was a humiliation for Jesus. And we do that through the reading that we have, because we have four accounts of the cross, but those four accounts are all we have. And the Bible, one of the things I've been learning recently, the Bible doesn't speak to us like a 21st century author does. You see, if a 21st century author had been writing this, even if it was fiction, they'd be telling you about all the circumstances, they'd be telling you about some of the details, they'd be telling you about how Jesus felt. We don't get any of that at all. So we have to arrive at what the cross was through a different route. And let me just give you an example of the seven things that Jesus says from the cross, which is the theme of our sermon series. What do you notice about those seven things? All of those seven things, what do you notice about each and every one of them? They're very short. This from a guy who, when he usually opens his mouth, can go on for page after page after page, speaking the words of God. But these seven words are very, very short. Why? Because he's hung on a cross. Because he can't do anything else. I mean, the way that John, I always love your reading, John. And I love the way in which you bring out stuff from the blank page, the black and white page rather, which is wonderful. But I wonder if Jesus, and we all do this of course, I wonder if Jesus really said, truly, I tell you today you'll be with me in paradise. I mean, he did say that, but how did he say it? Did he say it like that? Or could he just get it out one word at a time? Do you see what I mean by looking at what the Bible has given us, and through those words, understanding what's really happening, understanding the humiliation that this man who is God is actually going through. That he, as we looked at last week, has already prayed, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And yet here he is, struggling through the consequences of what they have done. As we focus in on the humiliation of the cross, we actually see Luke building that picture up in layers. Verse 35. The people stood watching. Let's stop there for a second. What are they watching? They're watching a man. They're watching three men gasping out their lives on this instrument of cruelty, which extracts the most pain out of a human body without sending it into shock, so that it endures that pain for hour after hour, and in some cases up to 3 days. Pilate was surprised when Joseph of Arimathea came to him and asked for the body of Jesus, and he even called the centurion in, didn't he? Because he wanted to confirm that he was already dead. He was surprised to hear this, because he'd only been on for 6 hours only. But in the midst of those hours, there are people watching. Now, we know that there are people watching from various groups, some of which are sympathetic, some of which are mourning what's happened. Some of which, as we read shortly, are sneering, are mocking. Some of which are just there to watch entertainment, maybe. It wasn't uncommon. Maybe it was just something to do, to watch men die. I mean, we're detached from that here in the 21st century, aren't we? But actually, I mean, if you look back in history, it wasn't that long ago that when people were hung here, that people would just gather and watch that as well. Okay, that was hopefully a quick thing. But people somehow are sort of attracted to the morbidity of somebody dying, which for us, because of the distance that we now have, is a sort of repugnant thing. But for many people throughout history, it's just been one thing that you do. I think about some of the states in the US for whom the death penalty is still a thing. But even they, even if they're going to go to the electric chair or whatever it is that they do, I don't even know if they do that now, or the lethal injection, they have the dignity of privacy. But that's not the Roman way. So just in those few words, we get a sense of the humiliation of the cross. And we all know that on the cross, you're fully exposed and open to everything. Luke continues. And the rulers even sneered at him. They said, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he's God's Messiah, the chosen one." The people, the very people that engineered this terrible event, couldn't just leave it there. But they even sneered at him, mocked him, whatever word, whatever translation you're reading. And used his own words or his own claims. Let him save himself if he's God's Messiah, the chosen one. Now he is God's Messiah. He is the chosen one, and yet in this hour of darkness, they're throwing his own title at him as mockery. The very people who have broken the law countless times to get him to this place, the very people who are so jealous of him that they want him out of the way because he keeps showing them up for who they are, those very people, they can't just leave it at that point. They continue to throw stuff at him, even though from their point of view, they've already won. Luke continues then by adding another layer of humiliation. The soldiers came and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you're the king of the Jews, save yourself." You know, when we get opposition from one group or one person, it's uncomfortable. Suddenly, if we're getting it from two places, it's unbearable. And here are the soldiers. Now, we don't understand. It says they offered him wine vinegar, which seems, from what Luke's saying, to be part of the mockery. So we don't know what that entailed, whether they were sort of pretending to drink a toast or what. We just don't know. But you know, the same kind of thing, if you're the king of the Jews, they're using a different title. They're Romans. They see him as the king of the Jews. The Jewish folks see him as the Messiah. So they use different titles, but they both basically mean the same thing. And they mock him for it, even though he is the king of the Jews. Then Luke continues, another layer of humiliation. There was written notice above him which read, "This is the King of the Jews." Pilate put it on there, we know that from the Gospel of John. And it was not just directed at Jesus, it was also directed at the Jewish religious leaders. But it was also an act of humiliation again. And it makes it all the worse because Jesus was and is the King of the Jews. And yet here he is, dying underneath a sign that he can do nothing further about. A label that's just stuck on him. You know, at school when people used to come up and stick something on your back or whatever. And the idea is sort of some sort of humiliation. It's the same thing. And then another layer of humiliation. One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us. Jewish, so back to the use of Messiah. And of course, Jesus could do it. And yet doesn't. I hope you get a picture of the layers, as I've seen it, of humiliation that even this short text shows us, gives us a sense of what Jesus is going through amidst all the physical horror of the situation. It's not just that, it's built up and built up, a picture is built of everything that he's going through. And then we come to the second criminal. And, you know, we only hear him say these few things. But in the midst of everything that Luke's just piled up on top, he says these words that break through everything. The second thing, actually, is what I'm going to start with. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. What's he doing? He's acknowledging that, yeah, Jesus is the King. Yeah, Jesus is the Messiah. He's seen through all the rubbish. He's seen through all the opposition in one form or another. He's seen suddenly. Don't know how, but he's done it. He's correctly identified amongst all the stuff that would push the correct identification of Jesus into away and into oblivion. He's cut through it all and he's recognized, yeah, Jesus is the King. And the first thing he says, which is to the other criminal, don't you fear God since you're under the same sentence? So he's not only recognized that Jesus is the Messiah, but somehow or other, incredibly, he's recognized that Jesus is God. Jesus prayed, forgive them for they know not what they do. Yet the only person possibly who did understand what they were doing was the guy that was on the cross next to him. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? That's such a depth of insight that can only come from the Spirit of God. Jesus' response, which is what I'm supposed to be talking about. Truly, I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise. It's both a promise and it's a word. And the word is paradise. The word lifts us out and away from all the humiliation. It lifts us away from all the physical suffering. It takes us out from this horror. And it lifts us clear of it. The word paradise comes from an old Persian word which was used to describe the gardens of King Cyrus the Great, who's actually mentioned in the Bible a number of times. And, you know, the Persian Empire was at least as grand as any that had gone before. And although I don't know the archaeology of it, but the sense of paradise is about a walled area, an enclosed area, an area of parkland or possibly orchard where fruit grows, or possibly garden, or probably a mixture of all three of those things, a beautiful place, a place in complete contrast to where we've just been thinking about and what we've just been doing. I do a little bit of gardening, as you know, and I know that if you want a place to be productive, particularly when you're growing fruit or vegetables, you put a wall around it, which is why you see in any sort of old stately home that you might visit, there's always a kitchen garden. It's got a 12-foot wall all the way around that enclosure, which is usually an acre but can be huge, because it holds heat in. And if it holds heat in, it makes the area inside, well, just makes it more productive, makes it easier for plants to grow. It provides different microclimates all the way around the wall for different types of plants or fruit trees to grow. I love the way in which, when you look at layouts, old layouts of those sorts of gardens, they've got certain types of fruit along the south wall, and then certain types along the east wall, and I just think that's so clever. But discovered over the course of many centuries, of course. And also when you go into those places, there's a sort of sense, I think the walls kind of give you a sort of certain sense of, oh yeah, this is a lovely space. This is a protected space. This is a space where I feel at home in. This is a space where I can relax in, particularly in some of those where the more modern ones have been transformed largely to have some fruit and some veg, but also some areas of other plantings, flowers and shrubs and all kinds of things with little places to sit. There's just something about those places that just feels so wonderful. So when Jesus uses that word, today you'll be with me in paradise, he kind of lifts the criminal out of the place that they're at, out of the humiliation that they're suffering. As I think about that word and what it means, that the sort of the idea of an enclosure, a parkland, an orchard, a garden, it takes me back right to the beginning of the Bible. It takes me back right to the Garden of Eden. That's exactly what the Garden of Eden was. A paradise, in as much as it was an area that was set aside for the first humans to dwell in, to look after, to thrive within. It was the perfect environment. And also, as we look at in the Old Testament, look at the tabernacle and the temple, there's the same sort of imagery as that. There's the same sort of imagery of an enclosure. There's the same sort of imagery of plants and fruit in the decoration of both of those places. They're both places that were intended for God to meet with his people. They both look back to what God had originally intended for his people, for the way in which God originally met with his people. And the word also is mentioned twice more in the New Testament, the second time at the beginning of the book of Revelation, where it points forward to God's future intention for God's people, which is to live on a renewed earth, an earth, a restored Eden, if you like. That is God's intention for all of us. And when he uses that word paradise, lots of debate about this. Does he mean he's going to go to heaven later that day? Maybe it does, but it's pointing forward to God's ultimate destination for everybody who believes. A huge contrast in this passage, which is why I wanted to read the whole thing, between the humiliation of the cross and the transformation of what Jesus was really about in the lives of the criminal who recognized him, and in the lives of all those who recognize him for who he truly is. Just in the last minute or two of what I have to say, just put yourself in the place of the criminal just for a second. Jesus says, today, you will be with me in paradise. I wonder, as we think about this, I wonder if you know Jesus. I wonder if you know him as Lord and Saviour. I wonder if he really is your Messiah and King. Because as we said right at the beginning, this story points us forward to how that we can know him in an instant. If you don't know him and you want to, anybody can do that. Anybody can make that step when they suddenly recognize what Jesus is, who he is. If that's you, see somebody afterwards. See me or see Darren or anybody that you trust. But for most of us, it's so easy to forget that that is our final destination. It's so easy for us to get caught up in the mess of life, and we forget what it is that we're intended for. Just read something really quickly from a book and a film that I really love. I'm not going to tell you anything about that because I don't want to take away. But this is just one of the characters speaking about death. The grey rain curtain of this world rolls back, and all turns to silver glass. And then you see it. White shores and beyond. A far green country under a swift sunrise. I wonder how many of us need to remember that that is our destination. Lastly, are we willing to be a part of God's plan of restoration? Again, in the sort of melee of everyday life, sometimes we forget that that's what we're about. That's what we're about when we come here. That's what we're about when we go out into the world. We're a part of God's restoration plan for this planet, this race that he has created. What a tremendous thing to be caught up in that. And that is what the criminal was unfolded to him in circumstances, as we've said, that are unbelievable. And yet even in those circumstances, the purpose of God is revealed through these short words for him and also for us. May God bless and use and move through these wonderful words as we seek to know him more and to see him more clearly in our hearts and lives. Amen. Joel.